Blog Talk Radio.
After a long hiatus, Bead Window is back. Tonight, we're back in the middle of nowhere. This is Stro, and my co-host when I'm in the middle of nowhere is Mark Lychek. Mark, you still there?
I'm here.
Great.
Lots of cobwebs to clear out tonight after 3 months.
Yeah, it's been 3 months. I can't believe it. But while we've been off the air, people have still been listening to our past episodes, so I think that's good. So, in fact, there was an episode that we had about it was an episode on First Lieutenant Lawrence that is continuing to get a lot of hits. People really like listening to that. So here's a couple of the questions that I had in the description for tonight's show, Middle of Nowhere. How much longer will Israel wait before they begin bombing Iranian nuclear sites? The second question is, how loud does Iran have to chant death to America before the Obama administration hears? And the third question is a bad deal better than no deal? So if you're a listener out there and you have an opinion, give us a call.
I particularly like your last point, because that's one of the reasons I suggested we resume the program after this hiatus with a discussion of Iran, because people that I think are pretty smart and generally have reasonable opinions of things, when I talk to them about this, they say, well, isn't any deal better than no deal? I mean, it's going to restrain Iran, and it, even if it fails to restrain Iran, we're no worse off than we are now. And I think that is a very fundamental mistake. I think we were much worse off with a bad deal than we are with no deal at all. And that's why I think it's a good idea to get into this subject, because really, I mean, it comes down to this. If we can trust the Iranians, we don't need to talk to them about their nuclear weapons, because they have repeatedly and publicly stated that their program, their nuclear program, is strictly for peaceful purposes. So if we believe them, if they're trustworthy, why have this negotiation? Why sign the deal? I mean, they've already said that they're not building a nuclear weapon, so we just accept that at face value and move on. I mean, isn't that a reasonable assumption if you believe them?
Yeah, I think so.
The Obama administration doesn't believe them, because otherwise they wouldn't be having these negotiations.
Yeah, I think that's an important question, because I think it's obvious to the most casual observer, but you don't hear anyone say that. You don't hear anyone say, I don't trust you, that's why we have to do this. We aren't having negotiations like this with Great Britain or France or Israel. We're having these discussions with Iran. They're the ones who can't be trusted. Yeah.
And people will say, well, you know, it's possible to negotiate with someone you don't trust, and they will cite, you know, our negotiations with the Soviet Union in the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaties. And to a certain extent, that's true, but there was, as Ronald Reagan put it, trust but verify. We had a lot of knowledge of what the Russians were doing. We could verify their missile tests, for example. In fact, one of the reasons we were such good allies of the Shah of Iran is we had all those sites on the Iranian border with the Soviet Union that we used to monitor their tests. We knew that their rocket telemetry before they did in many cases. And we don't have anything at all comparable with the Iranians, and the treaty framework that we've been hearing about does not give a lot of optimism that we would have any reasonable way of determining if they're cheating or not cheating. Even the UN, the Atomic International Atomic Energy Agency, which is not exactly a tool of right-wing fanaticism, is skeptical that the present arrangements can provide any kind of reasonable assurance that the Iranians are adhering to the treaty.
Well, what about the first question? How much longer will Israel wait before they begin bombing Iranian nuclear sites? Do you think that's going to happen? I mean, to me, it seems like it's inevitable. To me, it seems like if we do nothing and if we don't, you know, continue to squeeze Iran, Israel is going to be forced to do something.
Well, it certainly looks that way. As we were discussing a few minutes ago, the Russians are now preparing to proceed with a with delivery of a anti-aircraft missile system to Iran that was originally sold some years ago, but delivery was suspended because of sanctions. It would certainly make an attack on Iran tougher because obviously the stronger the Iranian air defense capabilities, the harder it would be for the Israelis to penetrate them and carry out a successful raid. So, I mean, I think that's got to be a factor in the planning, in Israeli planning, is how effective the Iranians can make their air defenses and how quickly. The other thing, of course, is where are they on building the bomb? And that's something that nobody, I mean, the Israelis may know a lot more than they're saying. Certainly we hope they do, but nobody's talking publicly about what's going on. I guess the one thing that seems clear, at least if you believe the Iranians, they don't plan on making any changes to their nuclear program based on this this framework agreement that the president, our president, has announced.
Yeah, well, the I'm thinking about why. So I was watching some YouTube videos today of some past, I think, for news magazine shows about what if Iran and Israel got into a conflict, and they talked about the S-300 missiles that that sale was suspended, and the last thing they talked about was, or one of the last things they talked about was the Jericho, I think it was the Jericho 3 rocket or missile, and it was capable of, I think it was capable of reaching between 2,000 and maybe it was more than that, 5,000 and 11,000 kilometers, depending on the payload. And they were, I guess, they were speculating that Israel may use that system because of the sale of the S-300 or the S-400 by the Russians to Iran, which would mean that they would have to use that system, and if they use that system, they would have to, they'd have to be nuclear, because if they weren't, they wouldn't be able to obliterate those sites, their three main sites that they talked about. Any thoughts about them carrying out a nuclear strike against Iran?
Well, I think what you're saying makes a certain sense, in that if they cannot use aircraft and bunker-busting munitions, it has to be by missile, then that probably means that nuclear warheads are the only way to get the kind of impact they would need to take out these deep underground facilities that the Iranians have built. But I also, though, I mean, the one thing that I think would argue against that is the Israelis have a horrendous PR job as it is. I mean, they are accused of all sorts of crap by pretty much the entire cast of losers at the UN. Even the United States isn't particularly aggressively defending them these days. If Israel were the first country in, 60 years to use nuclear weapons and use them in a preemptive, aggressive strike, they would, that would really make it tough on them, even tougher than it is in terms of, how they coexist with the rest of the world. And I know they're pretty much in the past, they're willing to go their own way when they need to, when their fundamental interests are at stake. But they do kind of need some support from other places. I mean, they're not totally independent. They need to import oil. They need to import other things in order to survive. And I think it would be a really tough call for them to do something like that. But if it were that or you know, ceasing to exist, obviously they would do it.
Yeah, I think so too. What do you think of the idea that it seems like, in spite of all of the red flags, nobody seems to think that this is a good idea, these Iranian talks, except for the Obama administration, which includes John Kerry, of course. The fact that they want this to be their signature foreign policy achievement, I guess along with opening the borders with Cuba, he seems to be.
I thought you were going to say opening the borders with Mexico, but
yeah.
Sorry.
Well, I started to say, and I remembered Cuba popped into my head. He seems to be pretty cozy with talking with the Iranians and with Cuba and anybody else that we haven't gotten along with. Is this all about legacy for Obama, you think?
I'm not sure, honestly. You know, he told us in 2008 during the campaign that he was not in favor of regime change in places like Cuba, Venezuela, Iran, that he wanted to talk to the regimes that were in power. And he certainly did that. In the case of Iran, there was a democracy, pro-democracy movement. There were significant street demonstrations in 2009. The U.S. did nothing as demonstrators were shot in the streets over there. And we basically decided that, you know, our strategy was to try to engage the mullahs and to come up with some sort of arrangement, you know, that we could live with, that they could live with and we could live with. But our demands are virtually non-existent. I mean, one of the things we can talk about today is the question of whether there should be some kind of linkage between these negotiations and Iran's general behavior, because the administration has insisted that there is no linkage, that the Iranians would never agree to it, and that the nuclear threat is so overwhelmingly important that it justifies us closing our eyes to all the other bad things the Iranians are doing. And, you know, whether that's reasonable or not, I don't know. But the basic point that, you know, you talk about legacy. Yeah, I think I see this. I mean, for one thing, it's a sad commentary. But if you look at Obama's, this is his seventh year. I think you'd have a tough time pointing to any accomplishment so far in foreign policy. So time's running out. Foreign policy is not something you can do quickly because it does require reciprocity from somebody else. And so, I think that there's a definite desire on Obama's part to do something that will, in his view, make him, an impressive historical figure. Of course, you know, Neville Chamberlain's an impressive historical figure as well. Everyone knows his name, but his legacy is not exactly, I think, what he would have wished.
Yeah. Well, let's give Obama some credit. I mean, he did have the Russian reset, Mark. So that's our show. We need to talk about that, and because that's what I want to do for the next show. That was what I want to talk about this, because Clinton is all over the news these days about the money they've been taking and the deals that they made. We should probably do that the next time.
Sure. Yeah, that's definitely a biggie.
Well, the death to America thing, I think that's the thing that bugs me the most, because even after and during these talks, there are speeches, and they're on YouTube, of these Russian defense ministers and the president talking about how they're getting the better of this deal, you know, talking to the Iranian people about how they're, you know, getting over on us. And in not so kind words, and to me, you just don't deal with people like that. Why would you deal with people like that when they're threatening someone who's a friend of ours, Israel, in that region? It's unbelievable that we would even have those talks with these people, especially since we had all the leverage to begin with, and we've given up all the leverage. The sanctions were hurting them.
Well, they still are, but not quite as to the degree. I mean, there's been some relaxation, but the major sanctions are still in place, and so there is a little time, but not much. And you're right. I mean, nobody that I know trusts the Obama administration to do this right, because they have made it so clear that they are anxious, desperate for a deal, and the Iranians know that. And they're sitting there, and they're just figuring, "Hey, we got all the cards. We'll just drag this out." Obama needs the deal. We don't need the deal anywhere near as much. And they may well be right. You know, it certainly seems that way in many respects. And the other thing too, you know, they're this linkage issue that we discussed a little bit earlier. The Iranians have made it very clear that they don't intend to change any of their behaviors, including regarding their nuclear plan. Now, some people say, well, you know, that's just they're trying to appease their hardliners back home. You know, that's a crock. Iran is not a mirror image of the United States. It's not a democracy. The supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, he can do whatever he wants. He doesn't have to appease anybody. And this idea that, you know, they have domestic political issues comparable to our own, and they need to sell this deal, you know, that they need to sell this deal somehow to the other people there, is, you know, it's nonsense. It's us trying to view Iran through the lens of the American political system, and theirs is totally different.
If you're listening out there, this is Bead Window Radio. Call us at 347-989-8743.
The only people who don't want to disclose the truth are people with something to hide.
At Bead Window Radio, we support our veterans. An American soldier is being held prisoner in a supermax prison. That prison is northwest of Kansas City, Missouri, in Fort Leavenworth. Don't expect the U.S. government to make another ill-advised trade. First Lieutenant Clint Lawrence is being held by his government, our government, for a crime against enemy combatants in Afghanistan. Like many American military personnel, Clint answered the call, and he needs us now. Please go to change.org to sign the petition to help free Clint, and visit www.freeclintlawrence.com. That's Lawrence, Lawrance.com. To learn more about Clint and for updates, you'll also find a link to both pages on the Bead Window Radio Facebook page. Clint has been there for us. Let's be there for Clint. Okay, we're back for the next segment of Bead Window Radio, and I'm with Mark Lychek. We're talking about life in the middle of nowhere. If you want to give us a call, you got to dial us at 347-989-8743. I guess we kind of cover it. I'm not sure what your opinion is on the whole idea that the Russians right now. I think this is fun for Putin right now to be flirting with the sale of the missile defense system, because I think it's just he's just trying to get under Obama's skin.
That's pretty hard to do.
What's that?
I mean, I would say that's pretty hard to do if you listened to Obama's comment when he was asked at a press conference what he thought about the proposed or the Russian decision to go ahead with the sale. He basically twisted himself into a pretzel trying to explain, well, yeah, this is okay. You know, the Russians were really nice. They didn't do this 5-6 years ago when the deal was originally inked, and they waited, and this is a defensive system. It wasn't covered by sanctions anyway. And, you know, he really went out of his way to justify what Putin and the Russians are doing. So it certainly didn't seem to me that there was any indication there that he was concerned about it. And I'm not sure that he is. I mean, again, goes back to this thing that he doesn't seem to understand that you can't isolate behavior that way. You know, this is interesting, just if I may, a brief sidelight. We were talking about legacy. You mentioned legacy. And there's a lot of people that are trying to say, well, you know, we could negotiate. Like I talked about this before. We could negotiate with the Soviet Union. Why can't we negotiate with Iran? But one thing that is interesting is in the case of the Soviet Union, we were pretty explicit that these missile treaties could not be signed in a vacuum, that the Soviet Union had to indicate by its broader conduct that, you know, they had changed their behavior. They weren't planning to, that they had accepted coexistence, basically, with the West. And if you recall, even Carter, when the Russians invaded Afghanistan, he canceled the whatever negotiations were underway at that time. You know, we can't talk to somebody who's in the middle of invading a sovereign country. Well, you know, the Iranians are doing effectively the same thing in say, Yemen or in Iraq even, and we just close our eyes to it and say, it's fine, they can do that, it's not part of the, you know, it's not nuclear, so we don't care about it. It's a very different approach, and it's not one that has any precedent, I don't think, as far as being successful.
Well, you know, getting back to what you said about Obama, about him in a press conference turning himself into a pretzel, I think that's his way of acting as if he didn't see, that he saw this coming, that this wasn't something that they didn't know was going to happen. Like, they're on top of the whole, you know, geopolitical situation, because they're just not. They just aren't. And I think this is just his way of acting as if he understands what's happening. But I know that underneath, you know, they talk about how calm he is. He's not that calm. I know what's going on in that guy's head, because he has no idea what's going on. He's got advisors that are ill-advised. I mean, you've heard his press secretaries over in the Pentagon. Well, not the Pentagon. That's actually a good one. But at the State Department and at the White House, and they just don't know what the hell to say about what's going on. They're the ones in a pretzel.
State Department lady, Jen Psaki or whatever her name is, boy, she's a real piece of work. I mean, she would stand there all day and argue that 2 + 2 = 5 if Obama told her it was. You know, I think she's a true believer. It's scary,
she is
honestly, scary.
White House. I'm sorry?
Sorry?
I didn't get the last
word. Well, she's, as I understand it, she is moving from the State Department to the White House, Jen Psaki, or Psaki. And like I said, I've listened to her, and the woman is just, she's pathological, I guess. You know, if Obama says 2 + 2 = 5, she'll stand there all day and tell the press corps 2 + 2 = 5. And she'll repeat it over and over again, I guess, under the assumption that if you say something 72 times, it will be become true somehow, like some magic incantation, you know.
Mhm. I was listening to the Iranian defense minister talk about those, the sale of those missile, that missile defense system. He's talking to the Russian media. And he was talking about it as a suspended contract that has yet to be fulfilled. I talked about this earlier. I told you. I said it was like if I was to hire a contractor to clean my rain gutters and he didn't do the work. They want the Russians to come in and finish the job that they were contracted to do, which was to give them those missiles, the defense system, to train them, you know, the whole ball and wax. They want the whole thing. Because there was an agreement, and they didn't honor the agreement. So while the Russian media person is discussing this with the Iranian defense minister, he's treating it as if it was a contract that needs to be fixed. Like, they need an arbitrator. Maybe it's going to be the UN to tell them that, hey, Russia, yeah, you have to give them those missiles. You have a signed agreement. And that's the only response he had to the idea of why they wanted these defense systems. Basically, because they got the money, they want to spend it, they want a defense system, and they want to keep the Israelis out. But he wasn't saying that.
Well, it goes back to the point we were discussing earlier. You know, they don't feel that that they need to justify their behavior to anybody. You know, they're entitled to do whatever the heck they want, and who are we to tell them they can't? And in the case of this specific contract, they clearly do not recognize the international community's concern over their behavior and how, what that led to in terms of sanctions and so forth. Because, of course, they, you know, their argument is that there is no, I don't know how you put it, I mean, there's no legitimacy to what the world community is doing because their nuclear program is for people peaceful purposes. They've made that very clear. You know, they've been up and up on it. You know, there's no reason for anybody to impose sanctions on them. That's their argument, and so this all flows from that. And you know, they don't accept sanctions as being legitimate at all. And I wouldn't either if I were in their position. I mean, that's a great negotiating strategy, and you wouldn't expect it to work, but unfortunately with President Obama, it seems to have worked. So,
well, what do you think of the idea that Iran, as a sovereign country, should be allowed to acquire any weapons it desires as well as nuclear power? Even if you and I don't agree on Iran, and we actually do, we agree on everything pretty much.
Yeah.
There are others that believe that it's none of our business, that we shouldn't be telling them that they're not allowed to do what we're doing.
Go ahead, sorry.
I was just going to say, is that just naive thinking? Is that just foolishness? I mean, that's...
You know what? Nuclear weapons have been considered in a separate category. I mean, there are two things that the international community, in quotes, has done consistently. One is to try to restrict nuclear proliferation. I mean, there is something called the Non-Proliferation Treaty. There's the UN, I think, has a as an agency. I mean, the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, has as one of its mandates enforcing non-proliferation agreements and providing a, you know, objective, allegedly objective investigation of programs being run by countries that may or may not be engaged in proliferation, stuff like that. So these people who say that are usually also the ones who talk about, you know, how important it is to have the UN involved in multilateral institutions and blah, blah. And yet they seem to forget that this is, in fact, the actions of the world community, in quotes, to, acting against Iran. And there's another area where this seems to work, and that is with conventional weapons in areas where there is tension. You know, I mean, where there's been a war, for example, there's often the so-called world community will get together and try to restrict the flow of additional arms into that area because there's already a hazardous situation. There have been conflicts, whatever, and you don't want to exacerbate the situation by, you know, one side then, you know, buying some missile system which will upset the balance of power, and the, so the other side needs to respond and blah, blah. You know, the world community, in quotes, and I hate to keep using that word because there is real doubt as to what it means and whether it actually exists, but if you look back over history, there are situations where countries have gotten together and done things, and that has happened in the case of non-proliferation. It has happened in the case of regional wars, of trying to, you know, tamp them down before they get out of hand. These are things that the world community, in quotes, has successfully done in some cases. So the same folks who are saying, you know, well, the U.S. has no right to tell the Iranians what weapons they can have, are the ones who normally preach about, you know, the wisdom of multilateralism and how well it works and so forth, and that we should do more of it. So I would say, you know, what do you want? Which way do you want it? You can't have it both ways here. Either, you know, the international community has the right to tell Iran certain things because they're doing so for the greater good, or they don't, in which case, why do we bother with them at all, you know?
This is Bead Window Radio. Call us at 347-989-8743 if you want to talk.
But I don't want to put the cart before the horse. We don't have a strategy yet.
If you have haven't donated to the Brian Terry Foundation, please go there now. The Brian Terry Foundation was established to honor the memory of slain United States Border Patrol agent Brian Terry and to create a living legacy in his name. If you'd like to learn more about Brian Terry or donate to a true American hero, please go to www.honorbrianterry.com. You'll also find a link on the Beat Window Radio Facebook page. You'll also find another link, a link to Secure the Border. Help honor Brian Terry and keep his memory alive. Okay, if you're just joining us, you better not be, because we talked about some interesting stuff, didn't we, Mark?
I think so. I hope so.
Yeah. I'm here with Mark Lychek, and we're talking about life in the middle of nowhere. Call us at 347-989-8743. You know, Mark, we get a lot of people that come in, they call, and then they hang up. And it's not because I think we're going too long. I think they just decide they're going to call and see. Because when you call in on the line, you can hear us on the phone talking until I activate the mic on the person who's on hold. They can't actually talk back to us. I don't know if they're calling in because they want to start talking or they want to listen, or maybe it's the whole call into the radio station kind of fun thing, because I know that's, you know, it seems like a big deal, but it's not. So if you're calling in, hang on, and we'll let you in to talk and ask a question or make a comment. Don't go anywhere. Speaking of going anywhere, how long were we going to go tonight, Mark?
I don't know. I was wondering that myself. Usually we talk about it ahead of time, but I guess since we're out of practice here after 3 months, we didn't discuss it. The normal length now is 45 minutes, right?
I thought it was 5 minutes, and then I think I was trying to. I think what I've done is I've made the show longer just in case we want to go longer. And if we want to go 45 minutes, we'll just stop it at 45 minutes. And we're at the 31 minute mark now, I think. So
yeah,
here we are.
Yeah, whatever. You know, you're the boss, you're the producer, so you make the decision. I think there's plenty to talk about. I mean, this is a very. Unfortunately, as well as complicated. Well, it isn't all that complicated. It's actually pretty simple in the sense that when it comes right down to it, we are banking hugely on our ability to figure out, anticipate what the Iranians are going to do. And there's very little evidence that we can do that and that we will know in sufficient time to be able to respond if they decide to cheat. And I mean, they're essentially saying we're going to cheat. I mean, they're telling their own people, they're telling the world, they're being very outspoken about the fact that they don't feel themselves bound by this agreement. In fact, I almost wonder if there is an agreement. You know, I read an interesting article. It was a guy named Andy McCarthy, who's a really good writer on security issues, a former prosecutor. He's the one who prosecuted the blind sheikh who masterminded the 93 bombing of the World Trade Center, and he was talking about this idea of a framework agreement, and he put it in sports terms, and we could use it here in Seattle to say, you know, talk about the Seahawks and their quarterback, Russell Wilson. You know, say that the Seahawks are getting static for not having offered Wilson a new contract. So the owner, Paul Allen, gives a press conference, and he says, we haven't quite worked things out with Russell yet, but we have a framework agreement in place, and all we're talking about now is the details. Well, you know, what he's basically saying is, yeah, we know Wilson wants more money, and we want to give him less money. So we're already talking about a framework here. We're just trying to figure out where that number is going to be and whether we can afford to go there. But the reality is there's no agreement until you got that number. And that's kind of the way things are with Iran. You know, until we actually get specifics, this idea of a framework is somewhere between self-delusion and I don't know what. You know, just Obama's unwillingness to accept that all these negotiations haven't gotten him anywhere. And, you know, they kept pushing back the deadlines, one after another after another. The Iranians didn't budge, so they just announced progress, whether there'd been any or not, as an excuse for further extending the deadline, which is now June 30, and that means nothing because if there's no agreement by June 30, it'll become July 31, and then August and September, and, you know, on until this administration leaves power. if the but I got a feeling the Iranians will at some point, because the deal will get sweeter as time goes by, they'll probably sign at some point, because they know very well that if the elections go the wrong way and somebody with a little more realistic view of foreign policy gets elected, then they will. This deal will not be there for them, and they know that. And this is a good deal because of the economic sanctions. We haven't talked about that very much yet, but those sanctions have been effective, and there is no snapback. That term that Obama used about, you know, claiming that it would be easy to put the sanctions back is nonsense. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit as we go forward.
I told you I had a clip about war with Israel, Iran, not us, Iran at war with Israel. It's kind of long. It's, I didn't know where to stop and start it, so I just recorded the whole thing. But it's over 5 minutes long. Do you want to hear it?
Sure. Too long? Yeah, I mean, who's the source?
It's, let's see, what is the source?
Because, I mean, this is a key. It's a key question. You know, it may come down to this, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's a news source. I'll put it on and
figure it out. Let's hear it. Sure, we got time. I mean, it's
tell me to stop it. We can talk about it. Okay, here it goes.
All right.
В Иран мы поставляем комплексы, которые.
We provide Iran with missile defense systems of a lower grade than the S-300 or the S-400, but they're still capable of protecting Iranian airspace.
The fact that somebody has anti-aircraft missile batteries does not necessarily curtail the ability of the Israeli Air Force to operate. It just compels them to operate differently. But they don't lose their operational capability.
Aware of international isolation, Iran is trying to achieve a totally self-sufficient armaments capability. But a lack of strong technical expertise is believed to have inhibited Iran from indigenously developing and manufacturing advanced armaments. This weakness means Iran only has the capability to produce lower technology weaponry. Tukan believes Israel maintains the striking edge with its ballistic missiles, especially the Jericho missile.
Israel has produced Jericho 2s and 3s that have the range to reach into Iran. Now, if all things fail with using their aircraft, they obviously have the option of utilizing their ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads.
Jericho 3 is the long arm of Israel. It has an estimated range of between 5,000 to 11,000 kilometers, depending on its payload. The Jericho 3 gives Israel nuclear strike capabilities within the entire Middle East. In his study, Tukan calculates Israel would need 42 missiles to effectively destroy the three main targets in Esfahan, Natanz, and Arak.
The distance is something like 2,000 kilometers. The accuracy of 2,000 kilometers is not in meters, it could be in kilometers, in 1,000, 2,000 meters. So you need a nuclear warhead to create that blast to do the destruction capability that they would require.
The use of ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads could create a regional Armageddon, a scenario the Iranians claim to be prepared to confront.
I see such an attack as possible, but unlikely. Israel knows that even with its resources, it is not capable of achieving its military objectives. The possession of long-range aircraft and so on does not indicate the possession of military prowess and the will to take the action. Furthermore, the Islamic Republic of Iran has taken adequate provisions to counter any such action, and in particular to retaliate against it.
The Shihab-3 is the longest-range missile Iran has successfully tested in public. Classed as a medium-range ballistic missile, its range is enough to put targets in the Gulf and in Israel within reach.
Iran would have that capability to retaliate, so they could very easily launch their missiles against Israel. Now, we don't know if they do have any, let's say, chemical, biological, or radiological.
They have thousands of missiles, of medium-range missiles, which can hit Kuwait and Bahrain and American forces in the Gulf. But as far as missiles that can reach Israel, probably at the moment they have like 100 missiles, these Shihab 3 missiles.
لا أحد يعلم عدد صواريخ في إيران.
No one knows the exact number of missiles Iran has.
لأن إيران قد تملك 100 تملك 200.
It could have 100 or 200. No one knows. But is Israel capable of taking all these hits?
هل إسرائيل قادرة على تحمل كل هذه الضربات؟
They can stand to take a nuclear hit and survive. If Tel Aviv is hit, it's over.
Israel knows more than anyone else the danger of an Iranian response. Israel lacks a clear strategy towards Iran, and the proof is that it issues such threats.
In June 2009,
Israel's Minister of Defense, Ehud Barak, was in Washington to discuss the sale to Israel of the Vulcan Phalanx machine gun. The gun can fire 3,000 bullets per minute. It can shoot out of the sky short-range rockets, such as the type fired by Hamas from Gaza and Hezbollah from Lebanon. Israel is developing the Arrow anti-ballistic missile system with U.S. cooperation. This is currently Israel's primary means of defense against long-range missiles, such as the Iranian Shihab 3 that pose a greater threat to Israel. The Arrow 3 anti-missile missile system is a longer-range upgrade to Israel's Arrow defense system currently in operation. It is designed to intercept incoming enemy missiles at higher altitudes and farther away from Israel.
You still there, Mark? I didn't put you to sleep, did I?
No, it's quite interesting. I had not heard that. I'm surprised there was no reference to the so-called Iron Dome missile system, unless that's what that Arrow is a part of.
Older, that wouldn't be in there. I think this is like 3 or 4 years ago. But what the there were some things. There's a lot to talk about there. I think it's interesting that this Iranian, I think it was an Iranian military. Or he was the defense minister, I believe it was. No, that wasn't who it was. Who was it? Just a military expert on Iran. I think there was an Iranian there that was talking about the military prowess of Israel, that they don't have the will. I thought that was just baloney. I mean, who are they trying to convince What's that?
Yeah, that made my ears perk up as well, because it just seemed like I know that the Iranians, the mullahs don't have a high opinion of Israel or Israelis, but they have to be aware of the history of Israeli military prowess. You know, you're the champion until you've been defeated, and no one has defeated the Israelis, and there's no expectation that they will. I mean, it certainly, if you look at the way that Israel has handled the threats, even, you know, most recently from Hamas and Hezbollah, they've done reasonably well. I mean, they seem to be pretty capable of managing. This idea that they have no strategy for dealing with Iran, I find that a little... Well, I guess my question would be, well, sometimes you can have a strategy, but it doesn't guarantee success. You know, there's not all situations lend themselves to easy resolution. And clearly Iran is a serious threat. I mean, this is something that I think maybe we should have touched on at the beginning, but Iran is not a country to be taken lightly. I mean, it has the world's fourth largest oil reserves. It has a population of 80 million people. I mean, it's a large country for that part of the world. It has a fairly good economy, even with the sanctions. They produce cruise missiles. They produce that ICBM, which apparently they claim is also, you know, is to launch missiles into space or satellites into space, which they have done. They produce over 1 million automobiles or motor vehicles a year. I mean, this is, you know, it's a serious country, and you can't just say, well, you know, they're not a threat because they're backward or whatever. They're not backward. I mean, they may be backward politically, but they're not, you know, they're not a backward country. And that's one of the scary things about lifting sanctions is that, you know, the sanctions may be there because of the nuclear threat that Iran poses, but the reality is the sanctions have been helpful across the whole range of, or I should say in restricting the whole range of things that the Iranians might be wanting to do. And so it's dismantling them. Even if we had a good nuclear agreement, I'm not sure, and we don't, and we're not likely to, you'd still have to ask yourself, is taking sanctions away good for the region? And I think the answer would probably be no.
And I would think that a lot of Israel's and Iran's neighbors have also said no too. Like Saudi Arabia has said no, it's not a good idea. We haven't even got into that, but we've gotten into that on prior shows about the Saudi strategy. Since we last talked on this show, prices have gone up a little bit. But the Saudis have also struck in Yemen against the Houthis.
Well, they've created a coalition. I guess the Egyptians are providing the boots on the ground, so to speak. And, the Sunnis, the Sunni Arabs are coming together, I think, recognizing that Iran has to be confronted, which is something that our government seems incapable of realizing it, though I guess we are taking part in the action in Yemen. Exactly what part is unclear, because the government, it seems to be, our government seems to be kind of hemming and hawing in terms of what role we are actually playing there. But to me, I'm glad that we seem to be helping this coalition in Yemen, but I also would still say if you want to talk about who doesn't have a strategy, you know, they're talking about the Israelis lacking a strategy. Well, what's ours? You know, what is our comprehensive approach to the Middle East? I don't think we have one. You know, what we're doing in Yemen should be a part of a broader, you know, mix of policies, plans, things we want to do, you know. And I don't think it is. I mean, I guess I don't see any sort of overarching pattern to what the U.S. is doing in the Middle East.
Did you catch that last defense system, the Phalanx close-in weapons, that we call it the CWIS? Have you ever seen that thing operate, Mark?
No, I'm not. Oh, you're talking about the thing that fires 3,000 rounds a minute?
Yeah. No, it's
No, I haven't, but I've seen earlier versions of that. Yeah, I mean, not in person, but I've seen video of it. It's amazingly scary stuff.
It is. It's really cool, cause it kind of looks like R2-D2 with a big gun.
All right.
We have that on basically all the small ships. Virtually every ship has it, but all the ships that I was on, all the small boys, the cruisers, the frigates, the destroyers all have the CWIS. It's a pretty amazing piece of machinery.
And what is its purpose on these ships? I mean, why is it there? To shoot down missiles, incoming missiles? Or
it's the last thing. It's close-in air and surface threats. It's anti-ship missiles. So it's something that didn't get intercepted. It's on its way. It's too late to stop it. This thing locks on and just throws all kinds of lead up at it to try to knock it down. I've seen exercises with this where they send a drone, you know, sideways to the ship, not at the ship, and the CWIS shoots it down. It's pretty cool.
Well, that's unfortunately what we need over there, because the Iranians are getting some of this stuff. They apparently have managed to clone a not terribly modern, but still effective Soviet cruise missile. And One article I was researching just after we talked earlier that says that the Iranians are developing capability to manufacture the S-300 anti-aircraft missile within Iran. And that goes back to the point I was making earlier that Iran should not be taken lightly. I mean, it is a sophisticated country. It is increasingly able to do things like that without relying on foreigners. And, you know, we just have to be realistic about Iran's abilities and what we might, you know, what they might be capable of doing. Because unfortunately, even though they seem to be getting stronger, they don't necessarily seem to be getting more rational. Maybe they are, maybe they're not, but, you know, we don't have any way to know. I mean, I think they're, you know, that's really the big difference I see between dealing with the Iranians and dealing with the Russians or the Soviets, rather, in the old days. I mean, the Soviets, for all their bluster, didn't talk about being a nation of martyrs the way the,
right.
You know, former Ayatollah Khomeini did in Iran. And that, you know, it's scary because the more power these guys get, you know, what? How do you deter somebody who thinks that national suicide is a good thing if it brings the caliphate, the return of the whatever it is, the 13th Imam, 12th Imam, I can't remember at the moment, but you know what I'm talking about. There is a strain in Islam, in radical Islam, of this sort of end of the world stuff. You know, that they, I mean, this is really playing out with ISIS, and these people, you know, you can't even say, well, we're going to kill you, because they don't care. I mean, they see even dying as moving the revolution or the ultimate triumph of Islam in the world closer. And that's what they're supposed to do.
Well, do you think we're getting down our last 8 or 9 minutes now? Do you think that they really, you know, the saying? I don't know if it's just a slogan or what it is, but that they say that they love death more than we love life. Do you think that's just something they say to motivate the ones that they want to go give their lives? Because, you know, Osama bin Laden didn't give his life. You know, all the guys at the top aren't giving their life.
Well, Osama bin Laden actually did give his life. Not voluntarily,
yeah.
But that's kind of the
but
way
not
it worked
by,
out.
But not by choice.
No, I understand. He didn't strap on a bomb vest and go blow himself up. And I'm sure that there's a real element of that. But on the other hand, some of this stuff, I don't even know, you know, I'm reaching for words and they're not coming. This sort of millennialist philosophy that runs through some of the more extreme versions of Islam, I don't think you can dismiss it entirely. It certainly is something that is effectively used to scare the opposition. When you talk about martyrdom and all this stuff, it's good PR, I guess. And it in the case of IS, it's certainly a good recruiting tool for bringing in true believer types from all over the world. But on the other hand, it's not totally made up. It's not all PR. And so I guess I would be a little bit worried if I were, and more than a little bit if I were Israel, because Israel has such a little tiny margin of error to work with. We have the luxury, you know, if we get hit with a terrorist nuke, it would be horrible, catastrophic, but it would not be the end of the United States. As that clip you played indicated, that, you know, a successful nuclear attack against Israel would almost certainly destroy Israel. It's such a tiny country, you know, there's just nothing, no way for them to survive. And that's one of the things they have to reckon with, and one of the reasons I think we, the United States, and people who are friends of Israel have to understand sometimes their responses seem out of proportion to the threat. But it goes back to this point that they have no margin of error, and so they have to fully anticipate every threat and respond to it.
Right.
Or else they may not have another chance. You know, the old thing about, you know, living to fight another day for Israel, that's a very difficult thing. By no means
well,
assured.
That whole margin of error thing makes Israel dangerous, I think, too. You were talking about how, and I think you agree with that, you're talking about the Iranians, what a threat they really are, what a serious threat they are. I don't think anyone has any doubt about that either, and Israel certainly knows what a threat they are. But do you think that might also be the Iranians knowing their capability and underestimating, I think they're underestimating the ability, at least from that last clip, of Israel to retaliate or to become a first strike, carry out a first strike against Iran. That could be the Achilles heel of Iran, just like all those other, you know, big talking, you know, the sands are going to run red with American blood kind of talk. It seems more like a pep talk than anything else to me.
Well, you're probably right. But again, I would say there are probably some people within the Iranian government who really believe that. But I think there are also people who are more sophisticated and who really do understand the concepts or understand the functioning of the Israeli state and how it works and why Israel would be a serious threat. I mean, I'm sure there are people that in Iran who are able to inform the decision makers about that. But to what extent they get listened to is, you know, it's not clear. I mean, we even see that in the U.S. You know, we have, as you were saying earlier, I mean, we've got some of the best technical people, you know, analysts around in the CIA and other places, but clearly that information is not making its way to the top decision makers, or at least it's not influencing their policy choices because they're doing all sorts of dumb things. And here's a case where maybe we do need a little mirroring vis-a-vis Iran that, you know, they can do dumb things too, even if they have good people that are telling them what really is going down in Israel. And they could certainly miscalculate. In other words, I'm not sure it's all PR again. There could well be some of this, you know, bravado that they talk about that actually does filter into the decision making of their top leadership, and that's scary too.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I bet you, I know that there's lots of people in Iran too that are going. Whenever the president or the Ayatollah says that we're a nation of martyrs, I bet there's some people out there going, "Not me, not me. I'm not giving
that's
my
true.
Life."
And when the next election comes around, they'll be able to make that. Oh, wait a minute! They don't have elections, so their opinion doesn't count, and that's the difference.
Right. This is Bede Window Radio. Call us at 347-998-8743 if you want to say something. Yeah, call us.
If you can't make money with a whorehouse, then get your hands off my health care.
Hey, it's time to talk about a very worthwhile cause. That cause is the Burn Children's Recovery Foundation. At the Burn Children's Recovery Foundation, they provide counseling and financial aid to families and also offer recovery programs to the children and their family. Over 5,000 families are helped every year. Please go to www.burnchildrensrecovery.org to donate and to learn more. You can also visit the Bede Window Radio Facebook page for a link. At the Burn Children's Recovery Foundation, they're providing hope and new beginnings. Okay, Mark, we are getting, well, we're actually almost at the end here. We can keep going as much. We don't want anyone tuning into another channel while we're on.
Well, what do you want to do? I mean, we can certainly go a bit as far as I'm concerned. There's a few things we haven't touched on yet, like the issue of snapback, as the president termed it, and whether that's really realistic or not.
I want to talk about that. Let's go into that, and then we'll wrap it up after that last part there.
Okay.
Does that sound good?
Yeah.
So let's talk about those sanctions. Can we actually reinforce those sanctions? I mean, how hard was it to get those sanctions in the first place? And how hard would it be to get them back in place, Mark?
Well, I think the answer to the first question is it was incredibly hard, and it didn't happen overnight. And this was something that started in the Bush administration, maybe earlier. I honestly don't know, but it was an achievement that took a lot of work by a lot of diplomats in a number of nations over many years. And the sanctions have worked. I mean, one thing I read recently, I was talking about the Iranian automotive industry. Apparently, in 2010, they produced 1.4 million vehicles. That production dropped last year to 1 million vehicles because of the sanctions. The sanctions are making it hard for the Iranians to sell oil. That's why you may have read a lot of stuff in the papers about how if this deal goes through, it may further depress oil prices because they expect 1 million barrels a day of Iranian production to become internationally available. Right now, the financial sanctions are such that the Iranians can sell oil, but they can't get paid for it because banks can't handle the financial transactions to ship the money back to Iran. And, you know, this kind of stuff is hard to do. And we have, you know, it's kind of sad because so often we have tried to put sanctions in place and they haven't worked. And this is the rare case where they really have. And our government seems intent on giving all that away for next to nothing, or maybe even actually nothing. And it really is sad because, as I was saying earlier, given Iran's ambitions in the region and the difficulty, the troubles that they're creating for their neighbors, you can make a good case that the sanctions are a good thing regardless of what Iran does with its nuclear program. And certainly we shouldn't dismantle them just because of some vague promise that maybe they'll do something to rein in the nuclear program for a little while.
And isn't that all they have right now, is a vague promise that they'll do something? And there are actually limitations to some of the things that are that we are putting in this so-called contract that will expire, that will have to be, I guess, renegotiated. I don't know all the details of the deal, but I know it's not a good
one.
It's not a good one for us if we.
You know, this is the thing. I mean, the president said there was a framework, which to me, a framework implies that there's broad agreement between the whatever it is, the 1+6, our negotiators, and the Iranians on the general outlines of a deal. So the president gives a press conference and says that. The Iranians give their version of a press conference and say the exact opposite. Now,
right,
our side says, well, they're talking to their domestic audience. And I commented earlier, I don't think so, because they don't really have a domestic audience that counts. They're not a democracy. Last time people tried to give an opinion about the mullahs, they were shot for it. And so at this point in time, I don't think you've got a whole lot of people that are going to stand up and really say what they think about this nuclear deal or anything else. So when the Iranians were talking, they were talking to the world. When Obama was talking, to his domestic political audience, in particular his lefty loony base, because
yep,
those people do matter to him. And there's nothing comparable on the Iranian side. I don't know if I'm making this unnecessarily complicated, but they have no need to talk to their people, if you will, because their people can't do anything. You know, their people are essentially powerless in the political sense, and they have to take whatever the government says and live with it. So there just isn't any motive for the Iranians to stage these things for their domestic political purposes. So I guess I'm left thinking, okay, you got Obama saying things because he needs to say them and because he wants the process not to be abandoned, and you have the Iranians saying things because they're true. I mean, that's
right. But you have the Iranians. They also have, and you call them the Iranians, and I call them the Iranians. I don't know which one is, if it's tomato or tomato.
I don't think it matters. Yeah.
The crazies.
But they do have supporters. I mean, there probably aren't a lot of them. I don't know if there are a lot of them, but there are people that do support the regime. And you would think that they are at least probably talking to them to some extent to keep them motivated to stay on their side. Would you think that's a possibility?
Well, yes. I mean, I can't say that. The Iranian regime could not survive if everyone in the country who was not a member of the regime, the ruling class, turned against it. You know, there is a base. They do have a political base, presumably the political base that the religious fundamentalists in Iran have had all along, which was the rural population and the urban poor. Those are the people and combined with, a certain group of intelligentsia that are radical Muslims. That's really who put the revolution together in the first place. And that's who's kept it in power. And the only thing we've got going for us is that over time, the Iranian middle class has grown. The urban poor probably has stayed about the same, but the number of rural poor has declined as the villages have lost population to the cities. And so maybe in 100 years, the political structure in Iran will be untenable. But, you know, we're not dealing with 100-year time frames here. The nukes are going to be here far sooner than that. And they will talk to their base. Of course they need to, and they need to rally their people. And they've got folks over there who, they have a domestic political audience. They do, and I shouldn't say that doesn't exist, but what I'm trying to say is it is not as important because fundamentally those people can't vote. They can't really express unhappiness if they're unhappy because they'll get stomped. And that's what the difference is between a democracy and a police state, a dictatorship or a theocracy, whatever you want to call Iran. I think a lot of those labels would apply.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, Mark, I'm glad that we finally got back together to do this. We actually haven't talked in person, face to face, probably since last summer. Has it been that long?
Well,
when
we probably
this?
Since the Panera coffee shop, I think.
Yeah. I can't believe it's been that long.
I know. It's been a busy time.
And then again, it hasn't been that long at all. It's been both. It's been a long time, and it hasn't.
Anyway, can I finish that last point about snapback? It'll take me about 1 minute.
Close this up, but go ahead.
Well,
sorry about that.
Just the point. No, it's I've been the one who's been wandering away. But there is one thing that I thought was very relevant to this, and that is the question of what happens when the sanctions are lifted. I talked about you take apart the financial sanctions that prevent Iran from selling oil. Those would be very hard to put back. Almost all sanctions would be hard to put back for the simple reason that the countries that worked with us to put them together are going to restructure their relationship with Iran. Once they're told it's okay to do business with Iran, they're going to, Iran has as the old saying goes, there's gold in them Bar Hills, and there's a lot of businessmen who are going to say, we need to invest in Iran. The Chinese are anxious to invest. The West Germans, I'm dating myself here, West Germans.
Yeah, you are.
The point is that once companies put tens of billions of dollars of foreign investment into Iran, and the Iranians violate the nuke treaty, and Obama stands up, okay, gentlemen, time to snap back. How many people do you think, or Obama's successor for that matter, how many of these countries do you think are going to be anxious to join that new round of sanctions after they've invested all those billions in further developing Iran's economic infrastructure? The answer is none, very few. And we're going to find ourselves with no allies. And at that point, it will be impossible to reestablish an effective sanctions regime. And the Iranians know that. That's why they're playing this, because they realize that once it's gone for good. And that's their strategy, and Obama is being played for the sucker. I don't know if he believes that snapback is possible. If he is, that just proves how out of touch he is. If he doesn't believe it, it just proves how cynical he is. But either way, he doesn't come out looking too good. That's all I wanted
agree.
To say.
Well, I think that was a good point. Like I said, glad we got back together to do this. I can't wait to do it again. We'll talk more about what we want to do the next time, next Sunday, same time. Okay. So for
look
our listeners, that's our show. Thanks for listening to Be Window Radio. I'll be back with Mark on Sunday night. Remember, you have a show suggestion or a question or a comment, drop us a note at guys@thebeadwindow.net. We're the guys. Don't miss a single episode of Bead Window Radio. Set a reminder to listen to us every weekend night at this time. That's 9 p.m. Eastern. But if you do miss one, our past shows are right here on Blog Talk Radio, and you can also find our podcast on iTunes. I'm a subscriber to that. I go back all the time, Mark, to listen to the shows to see how it went. So go to our podcast anytime to find out what you missed. For Mark Leitchak, this is Stro. Thanks for listening. Mark, good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you.